No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host. Oh, I'm sorry, my co-host isn't with me today. I hope my show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to us and affect the lives of everybody. You can call in if you have a question at 888-627-6008. And tonight we have a guest, a guy that I've known for a while. Jack Evans was a member of the D.C. City Council. He was elected in a special election in 1991 and served until 2008. He was on the Finance Committee. He was a Howard Dean, chair of Howard Dean's campaign, chair of Bill Clinton's campaign, chair of Hillary Clinton's campaign here in D.C. He was also a national committee man. The guy's been in politics since, Thomas Jefferson was a boy, and he's with us tonight, and we're lucky to have him. Jack, how you doing?
Great, thank you. How are you tonight?
I'm good. So,
great to be with you.
It's good to have you on the show and to talk a little bit. When I saw you the other night, you talked to me about D.C. finances. So let's start there real quick. Where do we stand in D.C.? You were the guy on the head of the Finance Committee for so long, head of Finance and Revenue. What's going on in the district now as far as finances go?
Well, Michael, thanks again. Thank you very much for having me, and I enjoyed talking with you at the event the other night that Tom Sherwood and Mark Seagraves put on for.
Two great
tax
guys.
Tax and Flack. As you mentioned, I went on the council in 1991 and served for 30 years till 2020. So I always like to point out I'm the longest serving council member in the history of the council member of the council. And as many people pointed out, I started my career last century. Although you've been around a pretty long time too. So we have a long history together and a lot of institutional knowledge. The things that are happening in our city today that are of utmost concern, certainly, crime is the number one issue everywhere I go in Ward 2 and elsewhere. People are talking about it, and maybe later in the show we can have some talk about that as well.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that I focus on that many people really don't or kind of doze off when I talk about it is the finances of our city, because at the end of the day, that really dictates everything, is how is our city doing financially? And I can speak to that from experience going back to when I first started on the council in 1991, when the city was in financial trouble that only got worse. And as you remember, by 1995, the city was literally bankrupt, and because of the actions taken by the city, we ended up having a financial control board.
Yes.
And it took a long time for us to work our way out of that situation, to put the control board into a dormant state and regain control of the city. And then a much longer time to really instill confidence, particularly on Wall Street, that we knew how to run our finances here. And that all culminated in 2018. when for the first time in the history of the city, we were able to get a AAA bond rating. And when you start out with a B-minus, it's a long way to AAA. But there was a lot of people, Tony Williams, certainly Linda Kropp, Nat Gandhi, Jeff DeWitt. There's people I can go on, all of our mayors along the way, who contributed to making that happen. I'm worried that we're in danger of potentially losing that, and that's what we were talking about the other day. And so why would I say that? What's happening in today's district government? Well, the last couple of years have been difficult for our finances, and we are in a situation today where we now have a budget of $20 billion, which is an astonishing amount of money for a jurisdiction of our size. And to put it in perspective, we spend more money. We have about 675,000 people in our city. We spend more money per person than any city, county, or state in America, and any combination thereof. So we spend a lot of money in the city. And what happened here during the COVID era, every jurisdiction in America, and we're treated as a state for federal purposes, got a lot of COVID money. The district itself got $2.5 billion of money. And much of that money that went to the states and to the city, it was well-intended at the time, but it turned out to be not quite as necessary as it was related to be. And what the city did, like all the states, is it spent the money. And $2.5 billion, a lot of money to spend, but we did. And we did some other actions during that course of time, which has inflated our budget to about $20 billion. And keep in mind, that's all one-time money. So at the end of the exercise, where we're sitting here today, I believe, and many people believe, we're facing some very, very difficult financial times going forward. I'm worried about it. I know a lot of other people in the government are worried about it, and it's going to be up to the mayor and the council to make some, what I believe, are going to be very difficult decisions, which are not necessarily easy to make.
Well, let me also point out, because many people may not know this, although we got rid of the control board, there are a bunch of conditions where the control board can come back, right? If we don't if we don't pay enough into the fund that retires our debt, if we don't, you know, there's certain benchmarks that we have to meet. And what worries me after talking to you briefly about the finances is also the fact that these guys on Capitol Hill right now are looking to get us. You know, they're rejecting laws, as you know. They rejected a couple of laws. They haven't done that in over 30 years. So they're exactly. Really, really on the hunt. And let me ask you, what about one of the things they proposed is getting rid of the red light and speed cameras, which are, you know, we have Mendelson, Mayor Bowser, Chairman Mendelson, and our attorney general all saying this will leave a $1 billion hole in our budget over the next 4 years. So all that combined, really, what can we do? What does the council really need to do? Do we need to reduce spending? Is that the thing?
Well, let me kind of outline just for listeners. The district budget is I always used to phrase it this way. It's a simple budget, but it's actually very, very complex. And when I say it's simple, on the one hand, our revenues that come in are largely from three sources: income tax, property tax, and sales tax. And between those three, they add up to 95% of our revenues. And then the rest are, as you mentioned, red light cameras and speeding tickets and things of that nature. Then the federal government also, like every other jurisdiction in America, contributes money to the district, and that's in the case of Medicare and things of that nature. So our taxes raise about $10 billion, and the federal government contributes about $7 billion, and the rest is made up of enterprise funds. So it's somewhat easy to understand this is where our money comes from. And our expenditures are almost the same way. We spend over 85% of our budget in four areas. Our human services budget is $6.3 billion. Our education budget is $4 billion. Our debt service which now has exceeded our public safety budget, is $2 billion, and our public safety budget, $1.7 billion. So that everything else you add in, you come to about $19,800,000. So those are the simple numbers. Now, what the problem we're running into is on the revenue side, we have some real problems. You start with the property tax. One of the largest areas of the district's property tax is commercial property taxes. And with our downtown being largely deserted, the value of those buildings are starting to fall. And the prediction is that we will lose close to $1 billion in tax revenue coming from our commercial property. And it's interesting, in the Washington Business Journal that just came out Friday, one of the headlines is deed tax decline is dramatic. And it starts out by saying the district has experienced a staggering 50% decline in taxes collected from its deed and recordation taxes. It's an astonishing number, hundreds of millions of dollars that we will not get. So when you start adding up the loss of commercial property taxes, the deed and recordation tax declines and other declines, we have a serious problem facing us. And what, unfortunately, the council had done in the last budget, and I always say it's kind of contrivances. We didn't have enough money to fill the gaps in a four-year plan. So what the council did is they started using one-time money. I mentioned the $2.5 billion of federal money that we got. They filled our four-year plan with some of those funds. They basically took all the money we had set aside to renovate our baseball stadium on a constant basis out of the baseball fund and used that one-time money, and then more money out of the convention center fund. They were able to produce a four-year balanced budget, but it was using one-time money. And everyone who has looked at this said, going into our next budget cycle, which will start sometime in next February or March, we're going to be coming up short maybe $2, $3 billion. And that's where the city is going to have to really make hard decisions. To your point, Michael, yes, you have to spend less. And that is one of the hardest things in government, is to spend less. Particularly, right, as I pointed out, when you're spending over half of your money in human services and education, and yep, another significant chunk in debt service, which you can't cut. And I always said, and then you throw in the police. So what are you going to cut? The homeless, the children, the police? Which one of those three? And the answer is none. So that's the challenge we're facing going forward. Now, we do have some protections, which you alluded to at least one of them. We have an independent CFO, and it was established that way during the control period so that we would not have a situation again where the city goes bankrupt. So our CFO, when the mayor and the chairman pass a budget, can say, this is unacceptable, do it over. He has that kind of power. We also have Congress, as you mentioned. Congress can overrule any law we pass or send back any budget we pass. We have reserve funds that we put in place, as well as the federal government, to cover shortfalls on a short-term basis. And then, as you mentioned, we have this, what we refer to as the seven deadly sins. And those are the actions that, if the district were to violate them, would bring back the control board immediately. So we do have some protections, but I'm just pointing out we have some serious, difficult problems. They're going to have to be faced come March. And I'll throw one, and I don't want to talk so long, but I'll say throw one more on top of it just to make this as bad as possible. Metro. As you know, Metro is facing a $750 billion shortfall come July 1st of next year, 9 months from now. Our share of that is a third, $250 billion that we will have to come up with if something isn't done between now and then. And I can tell you, from the lack of press coverage, from the lack of discussion, I don't think anybody's doing anything about it.
Well, let me ask you something about Metro, just since you brought it up and since you know a lot about it and we're on the board. And is the problem with Metro that it's run by three separate governments and we can't seem to come together? Or is the problem that the federal government doesn't pay its fair share, given that so many of their employees ride on it? But is that a problem? Is the problem that Metro is underfunded, or that it's just old and, you know, in disrepair? And, well, obviously, if it is, it needs to be better funded, right? So what's the problem with funding Metro?
I have a view of Metro, having served as chairman of the board for 5 years. And my view of public transportation is we have to stop treating it as a luxury and treat it as a necessity like we do police, fire, and everything else. Public transportation is enormously important, particularly to people in the city and in the region at the low end of the income scale. That's how many people get around to their jobs and everything. And the way Metro is set up is it's set up to fail. You identified one. The board is set up with these three jurisdictions plus the federal government to just not be workable. And you can't really get anything done over there. And if I had my view, I would get rid of the governing structure of Metro and put in place a board that had the authority to run the system without always going back to the three jurisdictions to get their permission to do it. Because we all have different views of it. I know when I was chairman, Maryland was always very reluctant. Larry Hogan was the chairman or the governor, and he was not a big fan of public transportation. Virginia was always difficult as well in their own way because their funding was almost not understandable. And they would even tell you that. You have to have a complicated chart to figure out how they pay for Metro. And unless all three jurisdictions agree on something, nothing can get done. So my view is this. Here's what we should do. Metro should be free is hard because free doesn't make any sense. It's no fair. You know, you don't have a fair or you have a reduced fare or whatever you want to call it. But I would charge like almost every system in the world except us in San Francisco, a flat fare. And I would make it a dollar. You could ride anywhere in the metropolitan region on the bus or rail for a dollar and make it so that people who really need it can afford it. How do you make up the difference? The federal government, you mentioned, is the entity that pays absolutely nothing on the operating side. So right now, Metro has a $2 billion operating budget. I'm just saying round numbers here. $1 billion used to come from the fare box, and then the other billion was split between the three jurisdictions. Well, the fare box is now down to about $200 million, which is why you have this $750 million shortfall. The federal government needs to step in and pay its fair share. And frankly, probably should pay more for that. We refer to ourselves as America's subway or America's transportation system because we are in the nation's capital and we are unique. So having said that, there is no will to do what I just said. None. Never has been. So Metro is going to have to I think the federal government's going to have to step in and fill that gap because I don't see the District of Columbia coming up with $250 million. And I can assure you, Maryland and Virginia are not going to come up with $250 million each because remember, for Virginia, that money doesn't come from the counties. That comes from Richmond. And there is no appetite down in Richmond to pay for a Northern Virginia transportation system. So it's a big problem, Michael. Big problem.
Yeah, it seems to be a big problem. And, you know, you would think as the nation's capital, we should not only be an example of a good mass transit system, but hey, come on, guys. I don't know if anybody's noticed out there, but global warming is kind of coming on us quickly here. And we need to promote public transportation, don't we? Let me ask
absolutely.
You. And now that you've discussed a little bit the leadership of the Metro system, let me ask you a question about leadership in the District of Columbia. Now, you've worked with lots of chairmen of the council and several mayors. Do we have the right leadership in D.C. right now? Do we have, you know, look, I've got to do full disclosure here. I ran against Phil Mendelson, but my opinion of Phil Mendelson is he's a nice guy. And that he's a good, he was a good councilman, but he's a bean counter, not a leader. What do you think?
Well, I've known Phil for 40 years, and I've known Mary Bowser for, you know, good 12, 14 years, as long as, well, maybe longer than that, as long as she's been in government. And I have a lot of respect for both of them. I think with the mayor, she's has done a very good job and has walked right into a firestorm, though, in her third term, between the crime, the finances, all the other issues that she's facing right now, the sports stadiums, you can throw those in. She's got her hands full, the homeless problems. So she's got her hands full, and it's a big challenge. On the council side, I think what I would recommend to the chairman is he really has a council that is divided, left-looking, relatively new in many respects. And he's going to have to take a real leadership role and make hard decisions that many of his colleagues are not going to agree with him on. Just to manage the council now is not a not a good position to be in. You really have to lead. I served, as you mentioned, under a number of council chairs. John Wilson, starting with John. John was a very strong council chairman. And he—if you didn't do what John said, John would make you do it. He was that type of person. I would say the best chairman I served with was Linda Kropp.
Right.
Linda was terrific. She had a way of convincing and cajoling people to do what she thought was right. And I was her vice chair for 8 years, and we never lost a vote. Linda was really, really good at what she did. And there were others. Vince Gray was good. I worked with Vince, and Dave Clark was more like more of a had his own ideas, but didn't have the support of the council. And that's when he was there when we got in financial trouble as well. So whoever's running the council these days, the chairman really needs to look at this and say, "I'm sorry, we cannot do everything we've been doing. We have to do it differently." And not do a consensus, but rather a leadership role.
Right. Well, you know, since you mentioned Dave, I've got to tell you a little story. I went to a fundraiser for one of my dearest friends, a woman named Audrey Baxter, who I think you know, and she was raising money for Dave. And I went to his first fundraiser, and I came out. And as I hugged her goodbye, I said, "This guy's not going to get elected to anything." So, you know, I never thought he could do it, but he ended up, you know, getting elected to many things. And since we brought him up, let me tell you, he reminds me of another guy that was a little awkward the first time I met him. His name is Mark Plotkin. September 22nd will be the fourth anniversary of his passing. He was a mentor to me, but I know he was one of your dearest friends. Can we talk about him for a minute?
Sure, absolutely. No, Mark was one of my dearest friends. He was certainly a personality, wasn't he?
He was a personality. if there's anybody that had statehood in their heart more than Mark, I've never met him. You know, he really was the quintessential statehood supporter.
He really was. He was very passionate about it and dedicated to it, and really didn't suffer fools when it came to statehood. But he, I've known him for many years, going back into the 80s when a friend of mine, Linda Greenan, convinced me to support him when he was running for the Ward 3 council seat against it was either Polly Shackleton or Jim Nathanson. I think it was maybe Polly, and then he ran the next time. And Mark was a character. He would go in and antagonize everyone. And so he ended up not winning. But he went on to have an illustrious career on the radio, as you know. He started out with Derek McGinty on Fridays, and then with Kojo Nami at his own show up in Canada, and really was insightful into the issues facing the District of Columbia. And, the stories are legendary about Mark, but I always remember telling him, "Now, Mark, this is off the record," and I'd hear him say it on the radio, and I'd say, "Mark, what are you doing? I told you that off the record." And he had this phrase: "It was too good not to use."
He really was a character.
He was a character.
Well, and I admire him so much for his stand on statehood. He got to ask the President of the United States one question as a newsman, and he asked him about statehood. He used it. He always supported it, and I miss him, and I know you miss him.
Absolutely.
So now that we're on the subject, you were on the council for a long time. They don't fund our effort for statehood. What's up with the city government and statehood? Is it just that we don't believe this will happen, or is it because there's really nothing in it for the politicians in D.C.? There's only something in it for the people. I mean, we have a small city government that has control over a lot of money. I don't know. It's hard for me sometimes to understand whether they don't care about statehood, they don't think it's going to happen. What are your insights as a former council member? How come they don't put any money? And by the way, let me just point out the one time when we needed somebody to stand up for our delegation, you did that, Jack, and we thank you very much for that. You took a stand and you stood with us when the council did not support us, but you did, and we very much appreciate that. So what do you think the feeling on the council?
Well, I get in front of the mayor's office. I think they've done quite a good job this time around. Mayor Bowser certainly is committed to amenities all the time, but Beverly Perry, who is my longtime good friend, really put her heart and soul into this, and I think you'd have to agree. She really, before the Republicans took the House here, she really thought we had a real shot at it. She had signed up a lot of senators, and you know, it did pass the House, and you know, you had to get 60 senators, which was always the biggest problem for us, because you know, that was a stretch, and unfortunately we didn't get there. And now I think you know, we're back on the back burner again until politics change. Statehood would be fabulous for the District of Columbia on the financial side. You know, I've been around this for years, studying the finances. How would we afford to become a state? And on the one hand, it's expensive. We do not control or pay for our criminal justice system. We would have which is outrageous that we don't. When the revitalization, I'm kind of drifting all over here, but when we did the Revitalization Act back in 1996, one of the things I wanted to get was control of the judges. And I have to tell you, the judges were the people who undermined our efforts. They liked being appointed by the president. They went around me to Congress. And what ended up happening is we ended up having the federal government pay for our judges, and they remained in that status. And that could have changed at that time had the court system supported us, but they didn't. So we'd have to pay for the court system. The U.S. Attorney's Office controls our federal crimes, and that would have to come into our Attorney General's office, public defender. So there's a lot of expenses. I think it runs maybe $800 million if we took all those functions over. The flip side of it is we are the only jurisdiction in America that cannot tax people who work in our city and live in other jurisdictions. And were we able to have even a minimum type of 2-3% tax on people who work in our city but live in Maryland, Virginia, West Virginia, et cetera, you would have way more money. I calculated about $1.4 billion to cover any expenses of becoming a state. And so becoming a state would benefit the city not only financially, but also to control our affairs so we don't have Congress doing things like you just mentioned at the top of the show of saying we can't have red light cameras or whatever other crazy. We can't send ballots out in the mail and some of the more egregious things. They bar our needle exchange program, our ability for women to have abortions, things of that nature. They're always interfering with their social issues that they wouldn't even talk about in their home states, but they can do it to us in the District of Columbia. Our gun laws are another good example of that. So, but, you know, the opposition is always there, Michael. You know that. You've been doing this for forever up there, and they don't want to change 50 stars on the flag, something stupid like that, or, you know, remember too urban, too poor, too black, you know, remember those, the three twos. And
we didn't have a bowling alley. One guy said we didn't have a bowling alley. One Republican said we didn't have a bowling alley or a car dealership.
they have no understanding of our situation here at all, and that's unfortunate. So, one of the things as finance chair for 20 years there that I had to deal with, and all of us did, is I feel like I had one hand tied behind my back because we can't tax federal land and religious institutions, and that made up about 45% of our land in the city. So that's off of the rolls. And then we couldn't have a commuter tax, so that took us off the books. And in spite of all those things, we managed to get ourselves a AAA bond rating. So I think we did a heck of a job in managing our money up until about 2 or 3 years ago. And so we can continue to do that. What I'm worried about is downtown, though, and I just want to focus on that for a moment. Right now, our workforce, the federal workforce of about 200,000 to 300,000 people, are not coming to work. And that makes up about a third of our workforce. And in the private sector, particularly law firms are one of our big groups that occupy a lot of our private buildings. And they have changed their model entirely, Michael. They are 3 days a week max. They don't want you coming in because they can have smaller office space, you know, sharing offices, et cetera, and save on real estate values. The mayor was saying at a dinner I was at the other day, she goes into her office every day and looks across the street at the Commerce Building, and she's never seen anybody go into the Commerce Building in the last several years. Nobody, no workers. And so all of this impacts, and it's not only, and it's a serious impact on our coffee shops, on our restaurants. I had a friend come to town the other day. We used to run our hotel association. And she was downtown. She said, I couldn't find a place to spend my money. There was nothing open.
Yeah.
So we're losing enormous amounts of revenue, not only commercial property tax, but sales tax and things of that nature. But the other flip side is, without the government workers there, Michael, people who come to the, like lobbyists, et cetera, who come to the city to meet with the federal government workers, don't come anymore because the workers aren't here. So we're losing another big chunk of income, revenue, and a source of activity in our city. And this has me worried because I don't have a solution right now how to get those people back. The idea of converting commercial to residential, I tried that for years and was somewhat successful. We got a building here, a building there. But right now, the cost of the conversions and really the makeup of many of our blocks, if you have 10 buildings on a block, you can convert the ones on the corners because they have what the other buildings don't have, windows. And if you don't have windows, you're not going to be able to convert a building into a residential building. Nobody's going to rent a unit without a window. So we face a serious problem in that. And that's something where we really have to get focused on how to get those workers. But it's like Detroit losing the auto industry. Once they were gone, the city collapsed. Federal government was always we always said, well, nothing can happen here. We're recession-proof because we have the federal government. All of a sudden, the federal government's not here. And that's going to be a challenge going forward, probably the biggest one we have.
Well, you know, you mentioned Detroit, and I think of where we went for the Democratic National Convention 1 year to Charlotte. Now, I worked my way through college, working at a place that I know you're familiar with, Bridges of Georgetown, I learned a lot from David and Ricky about the garment industry and the center of it, the center of the cloth manufacturing industry was in Charlotte. They moved out, all the jobs were gone, the city collapsed, and they reinvented themselves as a banking center, and it's really a beautiful, lovely a place now that's thriving. Do we need to do that? Do we need to reinvent ourselves? Can we reinvent ourselves because we've been so dependent on interaction with the federal government for so long?
It's going to be enormously difficult to reinvent ourselves in another industry. We certainly need to focus on that. And frankly, long before the pandemic came, we were focused on that, not being so dependent on the federal government for our existence, and had been doing a pretty good job. I think we had a city that, because of tourism, we were bringing lots of people to our town, both locally and internationally. We were developing somewhat of a high tech industry here. I remember we had a bill that gave enormous incentives to companies if they would locate in our city or start in our city. And unfortunately, the council repealed that, but that was working. And so looking forward, though, yes, we're going to have to look at how we can reinvent ourselves, even assuming the federal government comes back part-time, to be able to change how Washington, D.C. is perceived. But one of the ones that we have to do really instantly are tourism, which is in locally, nationally, is getting domestically, I guess is the word. It's getting back to where we were pre-COVID. Internationally, we're still way behind where we were for lots of reasons. International travelers aren't coming here. Our biggest group of international travelers, believe it or not, before COVID, were from China. And for two reasons now, a lot of the Chinese are not coming here. Our relationship with the country, of course, has really, really deteriorated. And so China is not allowing its citizens to come here. And then our visa, you know, our State Department seems to have collapsed as far as issuing visas and passports is concerned. And we're not able to get individuals into the city internationally. I'll give you a good example, too, is City Center, you know, where that is downtown there. Yep. With all the high-end stores. You and I would not shop at City Center because we would not want to pay what they're asking for things there. But we had a huge international community that came, flew into Dulles, came into town, bought everything in the store, got back on the plane, and that went back from whence they came, because it was cheaper to do that than to pay the tariffs to buy those goods in their own country, particularly in China. And that's lost. So these are other things that we really have to focus on, how we can regain some of that market share that we once had.
Well, before we move on to the 800-pound gorilla in the room, which is crime in the District of Columbia these days, let me just point out, Jack, that although the comments you made about the council and statehood, you said $4 billion for education, $2 billion for this, we pay nothing to promote the idea of D.C. statehood. We put nothing into it. We put a few hundred thousand dollars in. We need to put in more. But let's talk about crime. Right now, you know, we have this horrible situation where we just had these incredible crimes with teenagers shooting each other. I just watched the Commanders. I had to leave the Commanders game to do the show. But, you know, our running back was shot twice on 8th Street by a 15-year-old boy who they then discovered had murdered. Once they had him in custody, they realized he had murdered a 13-year-old or something. Crime is just, it's scary. It's happening. You know, we've had shootings in Upper Northwest, on Connecticut Avenue, on Brandywine Street. You know, it's really rattled the city. Let me first ask you, what do you think about the mayor's choice for a new police chief? Should she have promoted through the ranks, you think? Or do you think we need somebody from the outside? Because we're losing police at a record level.
No, you're absolutely right. And that losing the police is step one in what has happened here. You know, I, as a preface to this, I chaired the Judiciary Committee from 1995 to 2000, during the worst crime epidemic the city had. We had, in 1994, 500 homicides in the city, and that was during the crack epidemic. And frankly, when I took over as chair, control board was actually in place as well. And myself, Steve Harlan, Marion Barry, and a couple other people sat down and said, we got to do this completely differently. And we brought in a police chief from outside. That was Chuck Ramsey, who was terrific. He came from Chicago and really, really knew what he was doing. He was the second in charge there, and they had promoted somebody else as chief, and he agreed to come here. And as good a police chief as I've ever worked with. But beyond that, we redid the entire department, how it was structured. And I'm bringing this up for a particular reason. The PSA system didn't exist back then. So we put that in place. And the PSA system, the model that we have right now in the District of Columbia, which was put in place back in 1997, requires 4,200 officers in order for it to be effective. So when we have this discussion of how many police we need, it's not a random number that somebody made up. it's a model, which I happen to have in my basement, that this is the numbers you need to staff each PSA in the city, plus all of the special units like homicide, et cetera, SOD, on and on, in order for the system to work. Right now, we're looking at 3,300 officers and falling. So the step one in this whole process is we need to get the police force built back up again. And the council passed a law, which the mayor did not support, which ironically both the Senate and the House didn't support, but the president signed and put it into law, the Police Reform Act. And you and I have talked about this. That should never have been sent to the Hill in the first place, along with the other bill, the crime revision bill, which was an embarrassment when even the president shot it down. And we had both talked to the council about not sending that thing up and putting us in this awkward position, but they did anyway. But what the you had on your show, too, the head of the union, Greg Pemberton. And I'm sure he said what I was with him at DuPont Circle on Thursday night talking to everyone. The council law, the Police Reform Act, has made the District of Columbia the last place in the country that any police officer would want to work. It just comes down to that. The council criminalized a number of police activities. And as such, officers just don't want to work here. And the ones here want to get out. And as Pemberton said, we're losing more officers who are just quitting and leaving than we are by retirement. And so you can't be in a situation where you have yourself down 900, 1,000 officers. And I know the idea, you've had council members go, oh, we have this great, we have a recruiting class in our cadet academy, and all that's good. I helped set that cadet program up. But I don't need 100 cadets. I need 100 officers who've been on the beat, who know this city, and been on the force 10, 15 years. And those are the ones we lost. So one idea that I've floated is, first of all, the council has to change that law. And I know Chairman Mendelson, Brooke Pinto have all said they would introduce legislation to change that law, but I haven't seen anything. So that's number one. And then number two, can you go after the 500, 600, 700 officers who have experience, who left the force, and see if you can get them back? And I asked the head of the union that. He said it's possible. You may have to give them their seniority, et cetera, back, but get the officers back who know these neighborhoods. So that's step one. And then number two, I think what led to all of this, and I know the exact time it happened. It was when Charles Allen on the council introduced the bill to decriminalize fare jumping at Metro. I was chairman of the board of Metro. I was dead against it. And to Phil's credit, he and I were the only two who voted not to do that. They decriminalized fare jumping at Metro. And next thing you know, nobody was paying to get on Metro. And then the decriminalization of many of the activities in the city have led us to where we are today, Michael, where there are no consequences for the actions you're taking. People can go into a store, go into the CVS, steal a bag of chips and leave, and there are no consequences. I just had coffee with a gentleman who owns a store. He owns 9 of them in the city over at 8th and U Street. Okay. And he said 5 times a day, someone will come into this store and steal something and there's nothing I can do. My employees don't want to get involved. I call the police. They never come. Georgetown Safeway just had a ribbon cutting up here, a reopening, so to speak, after doing many renovations. And I was talking to the manager. He said, without a doubt, 10 times a day, people just steal stuff from our store, and there's nothing I can do about it. Because there's no consequences. If somebody's arrested, they're immediately released, and they know that. And it's not like somebody's stealing a bar of soap so they can go home and take a shower or Tide detergent because they can't do their wash. There's a whole market for this stuff. And that's what we're dealing with. We're almost in a situation of lawlessness. So here's what I'm doing. I'm doing what we in Shaw, we used to have an old saying, I'm celebrating the problem. Okay. So what we need to do is what can we do to address this? Again, getting more officers is number one. Changing the laws is number two. What did we do in 1995? Well, what we did back then, you can't do today. And we studied New York. I remember Rudy Giuliani was up there and Bill Bratton and people like that and some of the other major cities. And one of the ideas that was put in place by the police department was stop and frisk, which turned out to be a horrible approach to it. But it was effective in the sense we were seizing lots of guns. Comstat, which was where you would flood certain areas of the city with police officers, and then zero tolerance, where you just, no matter what somebody did, if they spit on the sidewalk or whatever, you'd arrest people. You ended up, as we know, with a lot of mass incarcerations, but you did return law and order. So somewhere between those things and today, we have to come up with solutions that returns law and order to our town so that people feel safe here. That's what it comes down to.
Well, I know, excuse me, I grew up outside New York City as a young person. I still have a lot of friends. I still have a lot of friends in New York. And I know that Giuliani received a lot of praise when he was mayor for doing exactly what you said, zero tolerance.
Yep.
That he brought zero down tolerance. The crime rate by, and it was the same situation. I used to go to New York City and visit a friend of mine that lived in the garment district and watch people smoke crack on the street in the middle of the afternoon while I was walking down the street with beast policemen walking by them, not arresting or even intervening because they got to the point where there were so many of them. You couldn't, yep. You would have spent all your day working one block trying to arrest them all. But they did that. They started to crack down I remember you could get long, 35 years before we had legalized marijuana, you could call and get marijuana in New York City delivered. And, they had all this stuff going on. And they did, they did exactly several of those things that you talked about. And it really reduced crime dramatically. Is this a problem that we have now on the council that we're too far left leaning? You mentioned Charles Allen, who's one of my favorite because he wants to let non-citizens vote. Another ridiculous bill that's been sent up to Congress, which you're going to overturn because voting is one of the privileges of citizenship. There may even be an argument for green card people who do pay taxes and other stuff, but he wants to let undocumented people vote. He also wants to let 16-year-olds vote. We can't, in the District of Columbia, a 16-year-old cannot drive a car unless he's accompanied by an adult. So we're going to let him vote? I mean, it seems to me that we're like every crazy idea or ultra-liberal idea, and I consider myself a liberal, that they run up the flagpole. We've got members of the council to embrace it. Have we gone too far to the left, you think?
Well, in the context of all of that, the answer I would say is yes, we've gone too far to the left. And when I was on the council again, with my 30 years there, I used to see what was happening. There are groups nationwide who come to the District of Columbia because it's easy to get a law passed here. Yep. All you need is 7 votes, and if the mayor vetoes it, you need 9. I remember when I got first elected to the council, that's what John Wilson told me. He was chairman. He said, Jack, all you need is 7. Once you get 7, you win. And so they come here, they try to get these very liberal ideas passed, and then they can go nationwide with them and say it's legal in the District of Columbia, so you ought to pass it in your different states. And so that's kind of the mantra that gets used here. And unfortunately, we become almost a social experiment with many of these things, and some of them really don't work. And so I'm looking at the council again. This is the same council that passed the police reform bill and also almost defunding the police. The mayor sent down a bill, as you remember, in the budget to increase the budget of the police department, and the council cut the increase in half. So they did allow an increase, but cut it in half. And also there was, and you can talk to Chief Conti about this, because of the council actions, there was literally a hiring freeze in place for about a year and a half, which is what reduced our police force by 900 officers. Now, there's not a member of the council isn't saying, hey, I need some more police in my ward. Where are the police? Calling for the National Guard is only calling for more police presence. And yet all of these individuals did vote to reduce the police force. So, you have to not get swept up in the moment. And I think when I was on the council, I was criticized a lot for that. I was the how do you say it, the fiscally responsible guys. You know, we can't do that. We can't spend our money that way. And people would get very angry about that. And I think that this council has a day of reckoning coming very soon where there's not going to be a way out of this. And certainly the idea is going to say, well, let's raise taxes, right? That's the final solution. But keep in mind, the District of Columbia now has the fourth highest tax rate in the nation. There's only three states that have a higher income tax than we do. And we're at 10.75%. And to raise taxes is only going to further exacerbate our ability to raise revenue here. California is at 13, Hawaii's at 11, New York's at 10.9, and we're at 10.75. And Virginia sits there at 5.75. And yep. So one of the things that I want to make, and very quickly on this point, people don't leave the District of Columbia. They change their residence. And the common place now where I see everybody going is Florida. Florida doesn't have an income tax. And right. So people will buy a house down there, change their residence to Florida, and all you have to do is stay out of the District of Columbia for 6 months and a day. So you can still keep your house here. You can still spend a lot of time here. You just have to stay out of here. And we are losing enormous amounts of revenue because of that. And I think the council has lost sight of how finances work.
Well, you know, since you brought up, I have a lot of friends that do exactly what you're saying, that go to Delaware for the same reason,
sure.
But live 6 months in Delaware. But you know what? Let me ask you, since we one of the many things we share in common is that we're both old geezers, is President Biden too old to run?
No. No, President okay. Biden is not too old to run. He's our guy.
And, yeah, and he's done a great – he's done a – you know, he really has done a good job. And
yes.
You know, I know my daughter – I have two daughters, and I know you have children.
Two daughters and a son.
two daughters and a son. My girls say to me, Dad, we don't need any more old fat white guys getting elected. And I always say, well, I'll try not to be offended by that comment, but but I know that's the way they feel, but he's doing a great job. And I think we should focus on that, but we're just about out of time here. So let me ask you the last major question. Jack, are you out of politics now in Washington, D.C.? You lost an election. Are you out? Are you going to run for mayor? Or are you going to come back in? Or are you going to, what are you going to do?
You know, well, unlike many people who say I'm focused on what I'm doing now, I'm going to tell you, I love politics. I loved being on the city council for 30 years. And as you can tell from our discussion here today, I'm still very involved in what's going on. If an opportunity presents itself, I would love to be back on the council again. But the opportunity has to present itself, and the voters in either Ward 2 or the city have to be willing to elect me. But regardless of whether I get elected to something or not, I will always be involved in politics. It's the love of my life. It's what I like the most, and I care about this city, and we put so much time and effort into making this city work. It's almost tragic as I sit here today with a number of other people and watch it start to move backwards. So, no, and I'm working on that, and certainly the football team, which we didn't talk about. I've been very much involved for years in trying to get the football team back in the District of Columbia. When I went on the council in 1996, I guess it was, we became the only major city in America without a professional sports team in its borders, because the Bullets and the Caps were playing out at the Cap Center. They became the Wizards. We didn't have a baseball team. And the Redskins at that time, now the Commanders, left town. So we had nothing. And I made a commitment, because I'm a sports guy and an arts guy. Those are my two passions. And I made a commitment to get all of the major sports franchises in the district, and we're one away, because we got the Wizards, the Caps, we got the Mystics, all the women's sports teams, the soccer team. Everybody is in the District of Columbia except the football team. So hopefully we will be able to put a package together and get the team back. I know There's a lot of controversy around the RFK site.
Yeah, very much.
There's no better place for a stadium in the metro. Putting in the abstract, putting aside all the, and people who live on Capitol Hill, I know they have very concerns about it. But putting all that aside, there's no better place in the metropolitan region for a football stadium than RFK, because it's just on a metro stop, and it has all the highways, et cetera, that lead to it. And given what the baseball stadium's done for the baseball district, I believe a football stadium would be equally as economic development-wise, equally as progressive. And the arena downtown, for instance, as well. So those are the things I'm interested in. But the arts are the other thing, too. And we don't do nearly enough in the city for our arts community. And that's another thing when I was on the council I was really, really focused on. And that seems to have fallen by the wayside as well. So these are things I'm passionate about. And so hopefully I'll have an opportunity to do something about them.
Well, we're going to have to talk about them. I have to bring you back, because we're out of time to talk about the stadium thing.
Love to.
I became a Redskin fan at 12 years old when my father took me into a bar, which you could do in those days with a 12-year-old, and I saw a guy. I saw a guy stagger out of the bar, a fat guy with red hair, and my father said, "That's one of the world's great athletes." I laughed. Watched a couple months later him throw a 60-yard pass to a guy named Charlie Taylor, who ran like a gazelle, and I fell in love, and so I have I listened to a lot of the arguments about RFK, and I really have mixed emotions about it because I'm a big football fan, but we're going to speak tonight, and let me just say now, just because there's been some controversy about this, I supported Brooke Pinto for election, and I'm supporting her for re-election. So I just want to be honest about that. But to thank you so much for being on the show and for standing up for us. And we leave our guest, thank you for 30 years of service. We leave our guests every week with a song we dedicate to them and to our listeners. Here's one from our hometown guy, Marvin Gaye.
Oh, great.
See you next week. And thanks, Jack.
All right. Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
All right. Good. Bye. We'll have you back.
I'll look forward to it.
All right. Great.
Give the people their right to vote.